It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. More than a week out from the primary election, it's still unclear who will be the Republican nominee for the U.S. Senate. Mehmet Oz currently leads David McCormick by 902 votes, according to the Department of State's website. The acting Secretary of State has ordered a statewide recount in this race as required by law. McCormick's campaign filed a lawsuit in Commonwealth Court to require counties to count mail-in ballots that were received by the deadline but missing a written date on the envelope. Mark Levy is a politics reporter for the Associated Press who reported on this case. Welcome back to The Confluence, Mark.
Thank you for having me.
Mark, which counties are not counting these ballots?
Well, I don't know, and I'm not sure anyone has a full answer on that, but anecdotally, we do know that, say, bigger, more liberal counties are more willing to count them. So Philadelphia, for instance, has said that it will count them. But the McCormick campaign has raised concerns not counting them or willing to count them, such as Blair County as a county that came up in its filing with the court.
McCormick is asking Commonwealth Court to apply a federal court ruling on a county judge election that was in 2021 to this 2022 primary contest. The Third Circuit Court of Appeals actually issued the ruling last Friday. What did that court say about this issue?
So that court basically said that it's unconstitutional and illegal under the civil rights law. The Civil Rights Act of the 1960s to throw out someone's ballot because they didn't write a date on the envelope on the outside of it. And it pointed out that it agreed with the plaintiffs, the ACLU, which is that this date doesn't have any use in determining whether the voter is an eligible voter or whether the ballot was received on time or cast legally. So it basically said that you're disenfranchising someone for something that has no role in determining whether that ballot is eligible and legal. And it said that the ballots in that election should be counted. And that was a judicial election from last November. I did want to add one thing to the earlier question, which is that the Commonwealth Court has asked the parties to tell them by tomorrow which counties are not willing to count these ballots in the U.S. Senate primary.
And what adds to this confusion was the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruling, a 4-3 decision after the 2020 presidential election, that said counties should count ballots without dates on the outside envelope if they were received in time. But going forward, an undated ballot could be disqualified for that reason alone, because voters would have had enough time in future elections to completely fill out their ballot envelopes. Mark, was that ruling must be disqualified, should be disqualified? Is that even clear?
Well, see, that ruling was on a different question. It was on the question of whether the law actually requires you to write that date on the outside of your ballot. The law says something in effect of voters shall sign and fill out the date on the envelope. And so it revolved around the meaning of the word shall. It didn't ask the question of whether it's constitutional or legal under federal law to throw out someone's ballot because they didn't write the date. One of the things that the federal court found is that they were counting ballots that may have had the wrong date on it. So the court sort of decided this question on two different questions, if that's clear.
Mm-hmm. And a note, of course, envelopes have postmarks on it, but it's, of course, done by the post office, not by the voter. So what guidance has the Pennsylvania Department of State given to counties regarding such ballots? Count them, but segregate them? What?
That's right. It's saying in light of the federal appeals court ruling, count them, but keep them separate so that it doesn't get mixed in with the general population of ballots, just so that you have them and you know which ones they are, if you need to pull them out. The one thing I should note is that counties timestamp every ballot that comes to them by mail, so it knows exactly when everything came to it and whether it was timely or not.
The Republican National Committee and the PA Republican Party are opposing David McCormick's lawsuit. Why is that?
Well, this would be in line with what Republicans have argued in the past, that that you must throw out a ballot that doesn't have a handwritten date on it. But in Oz's filing with the court, the lawyers make a number of arguments, and I'll just bring up a couple. One is that they're saying that, you know, you're injecting this ruling into an election after the votes have been counted, and you're injecting chaos into it. They're also making a couple points that we could see brought up at the U.S. Supreme Court if the county judicial race goes there, and that is that, you know, do these voters who sued even have standing to enforce federal law over these ballots? Mm-hmm.
And briefly, Mark, why does David McCormick think this will help him get ahead in the vote tally? We mentioned he's down about 900 votes.
McCormick has been beating Oz by about 10% in mail-in ballots. McCormick's campaign has credited that to an aggressive campaign to let people know when they ordered a mail-in ballot that, you know, that he was interested in having them vote for him. They did a digital outreach type of a campaign. And so as a result, they believe that helped them do better. They are doing better, like I said, by about 10%. But you know, most people watching this believe he's running out of runway. You would need thousands and thousands of votes at that rate for him to pull even with Oz.
Associated Press reporter Mark Levy, thanks so much as always, Mark.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. An elementary school in Texas is just the latest to experience a devastating mass shooting. At least 21 people were killed, 19 young students and two teachers. Yesterday, Pittsburgh Public Schools announced it would be on a modified lockdown in response to that massacre. We're speaking now with Tammy Hughes, a school psychologist and professor in the School of Education at Duquesne University. Tammy, thanks for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me.
Tammy, Tuesday's shooting is just so difficult, not just difficult for the parents or caregivers that may have just sent their children off to school, but also for the teachers and also for the kids. They know what's happening in the world. This is a reality for them.
Indeed, this has been a reality really since Columbine, and our kids across the U.S. have been practicing active shooter drills, and they are, you know, aware of media reports and of these sorts of things. So it does have a much broader impact, but of course is central to Uvalde.
Mm-hmm. According to the Centers for Disease Control, almost 6 million children ages 3 to 17 had diagnosed anxiety in 2016 to 2019. You work with teachers and school counselors. Are students scared?
Well, so those are separate issues, but the rates of mental health needs have been increasing and certainly were exacerbated by the pandemic. Having said that, when events like these happen, they certainly do bring up feelings of anxiety and, you know, acute issues of things kids worry about right now.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned feelings of anxiety. What kinds of behavior can young people exhibit when they are scared, but maybe they haven't necessarily verbalized that?
Lots of kids don't verbalize that they are feeling anxious, and sometimes they don't have the language to do so, meaning they're young kids and don't understand the labels that go with their feelings. But sometimes they don't even notice, right? And we all sort of have that. Sometimes you have an upset stomach or your neck hurts and you realize that it's really just stress. Mm-hmm. You will see all kinds of disruptions at home, sleep disruptions, irritability. You'll also see that in the classroom, difficulty paying attention, conflict with peers and adults. Mm-hmm.
And briefly, why don't they verbalize it if they actually do have the language to do it?
Sometimes kids don't notice, as like I said, adults do not as well. Understanding and identifying feelings is a complicated process, including the source of those feelings, which is a beginning part of just understanding I'm having an upset stomach and that means something else is happening. So it's not just a simple process.
Mm-hmm. Tammy, how can a parent, a caregiver, maybe a teacher, often also a very important adult in the child's life, hold space for a young person who is scared?
The most important thing is to be honest with kids and to tell them what's happening and to identify the potential stress, right? So you mentioned modified lockdown. And so why are we doing this? How is this helpful? How does this relate to safety and how adults are taking care of kids? So you do want to be honest. You want to use developmentally appropriate language based on the age of the kid. But the most important thing is to listen to the kids, pay attention to them, observe them. Teachers and parents know their kids. They know who's sensitive and who needs extra care. So watch and see what's happening.
You work with future teachers in the School of Education at Duquesne. Are they being trained to deal with the aftermath of such incidents?
We do expect educators to have a plan for crisis response that is both internally for the kids and the families, but also for teachers and administrators themselves. We need everybody to be on the same page to be able to respond to these unfortunate events, even though they are rarer than they might seem as they get reported over and over in the news.
Those plans, what's part of that? Is that the individual teacher has it? Is it done, you know, school from the administration on down? What?
It's done from the school administration on down. Crisis response plans should be both at a district level and at a building level. Often there is built-in community supports. Who do we know can come in? That may be formal mental health agencies, but it's also things like clergy and other important parts of the community that can come and help families during their time of need.
Mm-hmm. Tammy, how open should parents or caregivers be with their own fear or concerns with their children?
It's important to be able to model that you too have concerns and that you too know how to express and communicate them. When parents are unwell, when they are undone, that is not useful for kids to see because kids take their cues from adults. But being open and honest and talking about what helps them to feel better is useful.
Pittsburgh Public Schools started using the ALICE training program, Alert, Lockdown, Inform, Counter, Evacuate. According to the website, this was supposed to be fully implemented by 2019. School safety drills are becoming commonplace. Do you think there's a risk that these kinds of drills can frighten or even traumatize students?
There are a range of activities that happen during these drills, and some of those activities have been shown to be scary to kids, like using real gun sounds and those sorts of things. And so I'm sure school districts everywhere are compelled to make sure that the trainings they're using are not frightening to the children or the adults, frankly.
And very briefly, how can this kind of stress ultimately color a schooling experience?
Right. So the pairing of shooting and schools is not useful. And we want children to feel safe at their schools so that they can learn.
Tammy Hughes is a school psychologist and professor in the School of Education at Duquesne University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pittsburgh-based Temberitzans, who have performed around the world honoring and perpetuating international cultural heritages through live music and dance, are celebrating their 85th anniversary this year. The folk ensemble, comprised of university students, tries to share a message of peace and unity through their performance, which is especially notable as Russia continues its invasion of Ukraine. The ensemble has recorded a song in tribute to Ukraine, and we're going to hear that in a few moments. Joining me now in studio is Alyssa Bushenow, the executive director of the Tammies and student performer Nick Caladio. Welcome to the Confluence.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Yeah.
All right. So 85 years of being traveling ambassadors of cultural exchange. How has the last couple of years affected you, you know, during the pandemic, Alyssa?
So like any performing arts ensemble, the pandemic was pretty devastating, especially from a performance aspect. We actually were off stage for 517 days, which in 85 years of performance with the Temberitzans is the longest by far we have ever not taken a bow. So it was hard from two different levels. One, we really endeavor to have our students on stage. It is one of the primary missions to share these beautiful traditions of all these countries through our students, and to have them not be able to express express that art form in that way was very difficult. We did try to give them other avenues to express that, one of which was a collaboration with the Mattress Factory in Northside for a very cool installation. So we were able to get a little more creative with our programming, but overall, you know, very difficult to be off stage for that long.
Nick, the Tammys are students from Pittsburgh area universities. Why did you want to be part of this troupe?
Well, there are many reasons on top of it. First off, it is a legacy thing. My parents were both Tambritsons, and they brought me up in that tradition of loving my heritage of Eastern European dancing and song. And so just being able to do that, growing in university and touring and experiencing this culture is always fantastic. And it was just too great of an experience to miss to get to travel around and get great AV and performance skills.
Well, let me ask you about that. Second generation Tammy. So what have you gotten at this point from that experience? Is it what you expected?
I'd say, yeah. I have had the opportunity to work close with the sound and also just being on stage and being able to dance and sing and performing. I, of course, did junior Tambritsons growing up, but then I kind of veered off for a bit and focused on Ukrainian dance and Ukrainian singing and groups and coming back into the broader Eastern and Central Europe kind of performance has been really eye-opening and fun.
Have you enjoyed that, you know, broadening of, okay, there are similarities, but there are differences and you're learning and you're celebrating other cultures as well?
Oh, yeah, I think it's fantastic. I think that you can learn so much from other cultures around the world. So I'm happy that I could be there and learn from my other peers as well.
Alyssa, the Tammys, I understand, were originally formed through a trio of tambritza players. What instruments does the group play now?
So we've expanded over time, but especially within the last 5 years, we were really started as an Eastern European folk ensemble focusing on the tambritza, which is where the name comes from. But within the last 5 years, we've expanded to call ourselves an international ensemble, and we really do it all now. I mean, it's hard to find a country or an instrument that we don't have in our repertoire. It just depends on what our artistic director puts on stage that year, but we'll have everything from balalaikas to banduras to... you know, again, tamboritza is always still on stage for us, but really, if you have it, we'll play it.
A lot of string instruments or what?
So we do have a lot of stringed instruments still, including the original tamboritza, but again, expanded the repertoire to include now some electronic instruments. We have an electronic drum kit, also moving into Latin American countries, so picking up a whole new set of instruments there.
You have recorded a song, A Prayer for Ukraine. How did that come about?
So when the conflict in Ukraine began, we, you know, obviously have students who are very closely connected to that through their background and their families. And obviously through our history, we feel connected to that as well. And Nick actually can speak to that. He was the one who kind of came forward with this idea to have a prayer for peace and unity. So I'll let Nick jump in.
When the situation just started to arise, me and some of the other Ukrainian performers in the group felt called to do something. This is where we feel our heritage is from and we feel strongly about it. And we came down to three songs that we would like to have tried to do. And we wanted to go at the end of the day for the idea of hope. You know, one of them had to deal with a soldier who was dying and who will bury him. And one will do had to do with the Holodomor, which was this forced famine back in the 1930s. And we thought that if we can deal with this in the sense of granting hope and peace was what we wanted to go with. So we chose the Bozhe Velike.
And let's hear some of that now. Nick, because of your heritage, it's a message of hope. You said that's what you decided. But do you have, does this have a special meaning to perform this for you?
Yes, it does. This is something that if you go to a Ukrainian church, either Catholic or Orthodox, a lot of the time you will hear this sung at the end of the service. And on top of that, I had the opportunity to actually go and perform in Ukraine in 2018 with the Ukrainian Bandurist Kapella of North America. It is a Bandura ensemble, and we were able to go to some of the universities and some of the churches in the area, and we sang this song, and it was just so fantastic to be able to sing this in our home country right before this situation arose. And so it definitely has a special place in my heart.
Celebrating 85 years, Alyssa, the Tammies are holding a gala June 2nd and a performance of your current show June 4th. Tell us a little bit about that.
So every 5 years or so, we gather together all our friends, alumni, we call them the Tamily, to really, you know, celebrate another 5 years on stage. The Tam Britsons are the longest running live stage show in America at this point, so we like to commemorate that. And what we've really done is, as we've become our own nonprofit, we've really tried to expand the way that we gather people together and see if we can help that perpetuate the ensemble. So our gala fundraiser is going to be a great event. We have about 200 people coming in to help raise funds to keep the Tam Britsons on stage for another 85 years to come, dancing and singing.
And what else do you have planned for the anniversary year?
We actually already have 30-something shows planned. Our goal is to get to 60, which is a full roster. This will be our first full year back from COVID. We were fortunate enough to bring the show back to stage this past season, but kind of in a limited capacity, as certain areas were still ramping their theaters up after the post-pandemic time.
And finally, Nick, when your Tammy career is over, what do you think this is going to do for you, performing as part of the Tammy, sharing cultural heritage? What's this going to do for you, life going forward?
As I performed with the Tammies, I kind of had to put a little sabbatical on the other performing groups I was with. You know, I have not been able to perform with the Bandoriste as much or my folk band Corinha. But the skills that I'm really happy to bring back into that are the tech work and the stuff behind the scenes that I've gotten to do. You know, like performance on stage has always been so fantastic. But now to be able to bring in how to work on the sound a bit more and how to do that kind of stuff is going to be very, very helpful.
Alyssa Bushenow is the executive director of the Tam Britsons. Nick Caladio is a student performer of this folk ensemble. Congratulations on 85 years. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, some lawmakers want to streamline the process to certify out-of-state educators to teach here. Thanks to our team, Nick Konopka, Lara Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.